Main speaker for the evening, Diane G. from Huntington Beach. Thank you, Liz. I'm Diane. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I'm really glad to be here tonight. I'm not always. I'm not always glad to be in meetings. I'm hardly ever glad to be speaking. And I was thinking when Scooter was talking about being scared, I'm not as scared as I used to be, but I'm a lot more frightened than I was when I was new. Because when I was new, I just made shit up. I mean, I just said whatever I thought anybody wanted to hear, and I was an Indian for 10 years. And I finally had to quit being an Indian when my friend asked me why I wasn't working with my people, the alcoholics. I don't know why it was so comforting to me to be an Indian. I just loved them, and I had high cheekbones, and it worked for me. I don't know about you, but I spent most of my life being someone else, pretending to be someone else, acting like I was someone else, feeling like someone else, because who I was really just not enough. I mean, it wasn't even that it was so awful. It was just, ew. And so, one of the treasures about recovery for me is that I have been allowed to be precisely who I am whenever I am. And there are still people here who absolutely adore me. And who, not only do they adore me, but when I suck beyond belief as a person, when I do really stupid, foolish things like steal all the money from my home group and marry somebody else's husband, when I do stuff like that, that really isn't socially acceptable, they love me anyway. I have friends that I've had since the beginning of my sobriety, and I never in my wildest imagination could figure anyone could stay around me that long. Now I'm going to tell you, so we get all the number crunching out of the way, because it just hurts my head, but I got sober in April 4th, 1973. So if you figure real quick, next April I'll be sober 35 years. And I was 25. Next month I will be 60. It's really hard for me to believe. I look in the mirror and I think, nah, there must have been a typo on my birth certificate. I just can't be 60. But you know what, I am. Because then I try to get out of bed and all those bones ache. I am really, really glad to be here tonight. It's a ways from Huntington Beach, but it's a beautiful drive. And, you know, we both of our areas have had fires recently and had some serious damage to a lot of people's homes. And I was at a very good friend of mine's home this morning, and she and her husband lost their daughter to a police shooting last night because of drugs and alcohol. Earlier this year, a very close friend of mine lost his 22-year-old son to a car accident, alcohol-related. They went out at 5 in the morning to get Del Taco, but they were so drunk they couldn't walk, so they drove and drove into a tree. And what I know about alcoholism is that it is no respecter of age, of gender, of height or weight. It doesn't care. If you be alcoholic, there are very few things you can do to change your life and not end up dead or in prison or nuts. And that's questionable in my home group. If you ask them about me, they'll tell you maybe I drank a little too long. But I know. I have watched people in Alcoholics Anonymous recover from a seemingly hopeless disease. A disease that told me I could drink, even when everything in my life proved that I couldn't. When I ended up in juvenile hall in jail, when I ended up in car accidents, when I ended up with nobody in my family speaking to me, when I ended up getting beaten up on a fairly regular basis, everything about my life looked like I couldn't drink. But my head kept saying, if you just don't drink with those people, just leave the Hessians alone and go drink with the surfers. Then you'll be all right. It's them, not you. I was born in Lansing, Michigan. You have to be born somewhere, right? But I was born to people who probably shouldn't have had kids. And I think about this a lot because my parents are pretty decent people. I mean, I'm very fond of them as an adult. But they just didn't like kids. And so it was really, I mean, I'm not kidding, and I don't think it's their fault. They just got nervous around kids. So we felt unwanted. Imagine. And I have a brother and a sister, and each of us dealt with that differently. I'm the only alcoholic in my family, my immediate family. Both my grandparents were alcoholics, both my grandfathers and my grandmother. And I'm the only one so far in this generation who figured out that, you know, drinking makes you smarter. Honest to God, and funnier, and really pretty. I mean, I'm telling you, I'd have a couple of drinks, and I'd look in the mirror in that bar, and I was cute. And so I had to have a couple more. I mean, anything that can change your life like that. And I started drinking when I was 14. And I started because everything in my life stunk. I mean, my parents were always angry. My dad was really violent. Nobody, you know, they didn't like us around very much. And they were always yelling at each other. And my parents got divorced when I was 12. And so I had this aching, empty feeling inside. And I was also terrified of making a mistake. I don't know if any of you have ever experienced that, but God, I just didn't want to look stupid in front of anyone. It didn't matter if I was stupid. I just didn't want to look stupid. I didn't want anyone else to know. And so I was very cautious about what I did in front of people, what I asked, what I said. And it kind of keeps you isolated. So when I was 14 and somebody offered me this bottle of peppermint schnapps, sounded good. And I took a swig of that bottle, and honest to God, it's like a candy cane. Now, who would not like to drink that? So I drank more. And then that's when the magic happens. You drink a little more, and all of a sudden, you know you're smart. Because you know everything. And the more you drink, the more you know. And then you want to tell everybody. Isn't that true? You want everybody to know how damn smart you are. And I love that part of drinking. If I could have drank like that, I would have kept drinking. But something bad happens to alcoholics. I don't know what it is. But we never have enough. It's never enough. So we drink more. And then I started getting arrested because I wanted people to know how much fun I was having. And so I had to get out there. And then if you drink like I drink and you're out there, the police find you. When the police find you, they take you to jail. So I ended up in juvenile hall until I was 18, and then they took me to jail. And I don't like jail much. I don't know if you enjoyed it. I didn't. I have always been a really frightened person who got angry first. That's how I defended myself. If I was scared of you, I got in your face. But when I was in jail and I was 18 and I was scared. And I listened to those women talk about the stuff they did, and all I did is drive cars illegally and hit things and steal money. I mean, I didn't kill people. And it really didn't occur to me that I ever would. So I was afraid because I always, always said the wrong thing. I mean, I would always tell the wrong person to get screwed, always. I mean, it was just in me. So I was just terrified that I was not going to end up living to get out of jail. And when I was 19 and 20, I kind of went back and forth out of jail. And I was trying to figure out what the hell I could do to be normal, to be like other people. Now, it never occurred to me to stop drinking. That never occurred to me, but there had to be something. And also, I grew up in the 60s, and so if you don't like people to talk about drugs in meetings, plug your ears or do the na-na-na for about 30 seconds. Because I grew up in the 60s, and there were things available that helped you when you drank. There were those little white pills, and they helped you last. And if you drank with the Hessians, you wanted to last for the whole party, because they used to wake people up with lighter fluid in a match, and that was not my idea of a good time. So I wanted to stay awake the whole party. So I would do the whites, and then I would just be really awake. And the longer I got awake, the crankier I got. You know that feeling? And no matter how much I drank, I just kept feeling meaner and meaner, so they would give me these little red pills, kind of even me out. And when I took acid, it wasn't even illegal yet. So that's kind of, I did a little social heroin periodically. I mean, anything that I could get a hold of that would help me not to feel the way I felt. Anything that would help me drink longer, anything that would help me stay away from who I was in my heart, because I knew I was really rotten, and probably somebody would kill me at some point. So I kept drinking, and I kept moving on. And when I was 18, somebody said that I should try to get some help, because everybody in my family had kicked me out. So I let this guy drag me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I look around this room, and there are some young people here. I looked around that room, and those folks were old. And you know, the speaker was Chuck C., Dr. Kildare's dad. He was sober 18 years. I was alive 18 years. I figured this was a mistake. I mean, what am I going to do here with old people? And I left to figure out what to do. And I ended up getting married. I found some guy who didn't have a lot of requirement. And because I got to tell you, the other thing I've learned as I've stayed sober is I'm bad at relationships. I mean, I was wonderful at weddings. I had two weddings. I loved them. But the marriages were hard. I mean, because you're expected to do stuff. You know what I mean? Like laundry and dishes and cook. I still don't cook. But they have expectations, and you have to, like, compromise. I don't know. That was not a word I used, ever, compromise, in my way. Because I was so smart because I drank. When I drank, I got really, really smart, and I knew what people should do, including you and me. And so my marriage didn't work out, and I ended up deciding to go to college to become a psychiatrist. I know. Whenever you have trouble being grateful, be glad I never finished anything I started. Because it would frighten me if I were helping you. Oh, my God. I know a lot of people try to become psychiatrists so that they can kind of help themselves. And that never occurred to me. I wanted to help you. So I went to school, and I studied. I did all the appropriate classes, sociology, anthropology, psychology, and I ended up in Norwalk State Mental Hospital. That's who I am. Honestly, that's exactly who I am. That's how I drank. I had tremendous goals, and I had dreams. I mean, I really wanted to be something, and I actually did want to help people. I do have a soft place in my heart for people. I just drank right through it. And I ended up in the nut house, and I was looking around at those people thinking, I don't belong here. I'm not nuts. I know people talk about me behind my back. I'm not paranoid. I know these things. And I also was in a group at Norwalk called The Family, which was for people who have problems with drugs and alcohol. And I stayed in there for a while, and, you know, you get well. You start thinking, look, I haven't had anything to drink for 5 months. I'm fine. I got to get out of here. They're sucking the life out of me. Oh, God, we are so funny. And you know what's so funny about that to me is I do not have one friend who hasn't thought something like that at some point. It's like when I got married, I had to be married, had to be married. And I was married 3 months, and I thought, he's ruining my life. If it weren't for him, you know, it's like that's up here. That's all up here. It has nothing to do with my surroundings. It all lives up in my head. It's all your fault. I would be all these things I could be if it weren't for you. And that's how I was when I was married, and that's how I was when I got out of the nut house. I got out of the nut house, and I thought, you know, now I'll be all right. And you know what? I wasn't. I tried to go to meetings. I tried to hang out with people, and I finally ended up getting kicked out of everybody's house. Because I just wasn't fun to be around. I stole all my dad's money out of his rooster, and I used to drink in this bar where I worked in a bar, but I would drink next door because I wouldn't drink where I worked because I didn't want to be an alcoholic. And I used to do all these things. And finally, when I was 25 years old, I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I had not done one respectable thing in the 7 years from the time I was 18 till I was 25. I had not made one forward move toward a better life. In fact, I had nothing. I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous at the age of 25, having never finished college. I never knew you could get that many incompletes. But having never finished college, having no clothes, I had like 3 pairs of jeans and 2 t-shirts and no shoes. And a 1954 Chevrolet that I had never washed, that someone had given me. And I had hit almost everything with it. I mean, it just was all banged up. And I moved down here, and I got a couple of people who I was in college with who were in AA, I had them take me to a meeting again. Just take me to a meeting. And see, the thing about recovery that's so insidious is even though when I was 18 and I really thought you were too old and I thought I would never stay here, when I was 25 and I was ready and I really, really was desperate, I remembered that Alcoholics Anonymous is here. So I never tell anybody I can't help them, even if they can't stay that time or the next time or the next time, because who knows? Who knows what it takes for us? And so I came when I was 25. Now, I didn't come running in ready to do all the stuff you guys talk about, like working the steps and stuff, because that just seemed hard to me. And the part where it says you have to be honest, because I was still an Indian then, and I was not ready to give it up. So I kind of just slid over the parts I didn't really like yet, and I sat in the meetings, and I listened to people talk, and they said, you know, get a sponsor. So I listened to the people talk, and they said, don't get a man if you're a woman. Don't get a woman if you're a man. It's just cleaner that way. Yeah. Then they tell you when you're new, don't get emotionally involved for the first year. And if you're really smart, like me, you figure out right away that they're all the good stuff will be gone by the time you're a year sober. There will be no one left for you. So you don't listen to them. And you go to meetings. That's what I did. I went to meetings. I went to meetings so that I could find him, God's will for me. I needed somebody in my life who loved me. Because God knows I didn't. So I needed somebody. And I went to meetings looking for God's will. And I found him. I did. You know what? This is such an interesting experience. I'm sure some of you will identify with it. I met him. He was at a podium speaking. Now, I had gotten a sponsor by that time. They called her Crazy Annie. They later called her Irish Annie, and she was one of the best things that ever happened in my life. But when they called her Crazy Annie, she was crazy. And she used to swear from the podium just so she could watch people's jaws drop. And she tried to kill her husband, and she was just a really interesting person. And so I saw this guy up there, all this brown hair and big brown eyes, and they called him Crazy John. And I knew that was God's will for me. I mean, like that. I knew it. And so I went up and talked to him after the Alcathon, and I said, you know, I play guitar. I was 10 months sober. We both played guitar. You know, you're meant to be together when that happens. So we figured out, you know, what was going on, and he went and explained to his wife and kids what had happened. That part never gets easier. But, you know, the truth is, it never occurred to me that anyone else had feelings outside of me. It took a lot of years of a lot of people getting in my face and hurting my feelings before I understood that I hurt theirs. Before I understood that my behavior could damage someone else. My behavior could cause someone else pain. And that's my responsibility. It took me a long time to understand that. But she was a lovely woman and gave us the kids. So, I know maybe that was her small way of getting even, but I waited. By the time God's will was divorced, I was sober 2.5 years, and we got married. And you know, you always know you're going to live happily ever after. And you know, this is it. Meant to be. 11 months, and we were ready to kill each other. And what I know about that is, if you're immature, if you have the emotional maturity of a 12-year-old, you should not be married. Weddings are fun. It's like a big party. Marriage is work. And if you're 12, you really shouldn't do it. And that's where I was. I was just so immature. And I still had no idea that other people had value. It took me a long time. So God's will, and I got divorced, and he went and practiced his principles and other affairs, and I got flopped into recovery by my sponsor, because she believed that if I was going to stay sober, I needed to quit lying, I needed to quit being married, quit looking for God's will in the meetings, and I needed to do some service job that nobody else wanted. In my area, that's general service. Nobody wanted it, because they used to boo the GSR from the back of the room. You just get really wound up in your report, and then you'd hear these boos, a little quiet at first, and oh my God. And she made me do that for 2 years. And so I worked out a deal with the guys in the group. If they would just shut up for my report, I would keep it short. And if they insisted on booing me, I would talk for 20 minutes. And you know what? If your GSR worked for me, and I kept it short, and they didn't boo me. And I got a lot of knowledge about Alcoholics Anonymous. AA comes of age. I read the book. I actually ended up being delegate for the Mid-Southern California area in 1982 and 83. I went to New York as delegate, and thought, what am I doing here? I mean, have you ever been in a position in AA, in a service position, and you thought, oh my God, I don't know anything about this. They're going to impeach me. I mean, if they understand just how unaware and uninformed I am, they're going to get rid of me, and they're going to be so sorry. I mean, of course, it was still all about me, but I went to New York, and I'm sitting out there with all these people, and I'm completely intimidated, and I really felt like I was going to fail at this job. And my friend George, who was the trustee at the time, said, you know, Diane, because I wanted to go home, I just want to go home, I don't want to do this, I'm not going to be good. He said, one of these days, Diane, you'll just have to quit worrying about how you feel. Because you know what? Nobody cares how you feel. And it doesn't matter how you feel. And nobody, in 5 years, nobody will even remember that you were delegate. But there are jobs that need to be done. And it is your obligation to do it. It doesn't matter how you do it. And you know, I started thinking, when I was new, my feelings changed every 30 seconds. So it probably really doesn't matter how I feel. And when I don't want to go to a meeting, and I go anyway, I always feel better. Always feel better. When I'm thinking about me and how pitiful and messed up I am, and somebody calls and they're having a real problem, and I talk to them, always feel better. So I listened to my friend George, and I stayed in New York. And you know what? I did an adequate job. I did an adequate job as delegate, and I had a good time. I met a lot of people who I still see and who I go visit in New York, and my life changed. And in 1985, when I was sometime 84, 85, after I was finished being delegate and I was back in Orange County and just back to being a regular old alcoholic, I started getting depressed. And you know, I didn't know I was depressed. If you're like me, you drank through every feeling you ever had, and then you don't recognize them when they come up again. I mean, I didn't recognize. I didn't know. I just knew that everything made me cry. Everything made me sad, and I didn't want to do anything. And I didn't want to talk to anybody, and I had started sponsoring people and really enjoyed sponsoring people and liked talking to people, and all of a sudden I didn't like it anymore. And I'd actually gotten a job. Job. And I actually was pretty good at it. I went to school to become a psychiatrist, and you all know I didn't finish that. So when I got sober, I had to get a job to be self-supporting, and the only job I could get was driving a pickup truck, which I didn't know how to drive because it was a stick. And the guy gave me the keys. He said, if you can learn, you can have the job. It was for a typesetting company. I learned how to drive in 10 minutes. I got the job. I did that for a year. Their typesetter quit. They taught me how to set type on the old standalone composers. And from that job, from not saying no to driving a pickup truck, I have the job I have today, which is managing editor for a publishing company. We do auto racing magazines. I don't like auto racing. I love my job. And I am so good at it. I would have never had this job if I would have listened to my good ideas. Never. And so when my friend Jim, I was crying. I wasn't going to meetings. I was not work. I didn't want to work. I didn't want to go to my job. I knew something was wrong. And my friend Jim, who's sober, who is also a psychologist, said, "You sound depressed to me." And what ended up happening, I'm not going to make this really long because it was a very difficult period of sobriety, and I can tell you the one thing I did right, I didn't drink. That is the one thing I did right during that period. I didn't go to meetings, I didn't talk to people, I didn't want to sponsor anyone. I would say I would come speak and I wouldn't. I did everything that you can do to sabotage yourself. I did during that 4-year period of time. I wanted to die. I thought that you wasted a lot of good time on me and that I would never, ever be able to give you back what you gave me. You know what? I don't know if I ever will. But there's no reason not to keep trying. And through that 4-year period, I got a little bit of help. Somebody insisted on getting me some help. And so I had this little psychologist. And he used to tell me that no matter what happened to me, no matter what I felt like, I had to get my butt into the AA meetings because those people cared about me. And as long as somebody cared about me, I had no right to kill myself. No right. Suicide is an angry, selfish thing to do. And he's right, because a year later he took a gun and blew his head off. And I got to tell you, I thought it was my fault. I thought that because he spent so much time with me and because he helped me so much, that he didn't have enough time to take care of himself. And I got to tell you, what I know is sometimes people lead us to the light. They can see it for us and they can lead us there, but they don't ever see it for themselves. And I don't, if I could give everyone what I found in recovery, I would give it to you. But mine isn't yours. There is something there for everyone, and you just have to be willing to do the footwork. You just have to be willing to go to whatever lengths it is that's required of you to stay sober. For me, I know what it is. After the psychologist killed himself, I was devastated. But I didn't go back in my house and lock myself up. I went to meetings. and I cried and I let people love me, and I stayed in meetings and I started helping people and I started going to H&I meetings and I got involved and I started going to talk at the juvenile hall where I was incarcerated as a youth. And they were great kids. I loved these kids. And we used to talk and talk about, you know, life. And there was this one kid in there who had driven a van with five of his friends in it. They were all drunk. And they died. And he was the only one who lived. And he was 18. And I thought, easily could have been me. Easily could have been me. So I kept going back. And I have some friends who are race car drivers. And one in particular was just a wonderful guy. His dad was an alcoholic. And we had a lot of talks about recovery and about alcoholism. And so he went out to juvenile hall with me. And he was great with the guys. I had a bunch of young guys that I used to talk to. I loved them. And he was great with them. They loved him. He had a new twist on how to go for your dreams and never give up on yourself. And in 1996, he got killed in a race in Toronto. Just one more hard thing. And the kids had a really hard time because they didn't know how to bridge the gap between, you know, what they saw in him and him getting killed. So I started going out to juvenile hall every week, and I started talking to him every week about stuff, and then pretty soon I ran out of stuff to say, and I saw these other ladies bringing things to bake, like cake and brownies and cookies and stuff. Now, believe me when I tell you, I don't cook. Don't cook, don't like it, don't want to learn. But I did learn at that point how to read directions. I followed directions, and the worst thing I ever did was leave the eggs out once, but they didn't notice. And we baked. We baked all of these things, and they ate them, and they shared their hearts with me. And it was the most healing period of my life. There is nothing like talking to another alcoholic. There's nothing like it. There's nothing like the sickness that lives in me from time to time. There's nothing like that to heal it. I have been a recovering alcoholic for 34 years, and the best I feel is when I'm hanging out with you, because my hope lives in you. In here, no hope. In here, no sense. In here, chaos. But with you, I have hope. With you, I have joy. And with you, I can see it. I can see it in you when I can't see it in me. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have continued to go to meetings. The thing that has happened for me is I still have a sponsor. I still go to meetings. I still sponsor people. But, you know, life gets bigger. You know, I have my job. I've had the same job 23 years. Life gets bigger and things keep happening and you get out into the mainstream. And as I got really busy and I started gaining weight. And I'm only telling you this to let you know that you never have to give up on wanting something different for yourself. I gained about 120 pounds. And it took me a long time to figure out that I was still an okay person, but it was cumbersome to get around with an extra 120 pounds. And it stopped me from enjoying things, and I would get a little bit embarrassed. And so, close to 3 years ago now, I got involved in another 12-step program, because I kept thinking I should be able to do it in AA, same 12 steps. But it's not the same focus. Alcoholics Anonymous is to recover from alcoholism. And the other issues you have in life, there's always something there. And I got involved in this other 12-step program and lost 110 pounds. And I probably could lose the other 10, but I kind of like it. So I probably won't. And life has just continually gotten better. I always wanted to sing. All my life, love music. And my mom used to tell me when we would sing in the car, and she would say, "Stop it. Don't do it." And I don't know why she did that. I think probably because when you're a kid, you probably don't sing everything right, and my mom didn't like that. My mom didn't like kids. So that's probably one of the reasons. And for a long time, I carried that with me, that I couldn't sing, and so I would sing in private. I can sing, actually. And I ran into a guy in the oddest of circumstances who is one of the best vocal coaches I've run across in my life. I mean, he's an amazing guy. And he loved my voice, and he's taught me how to sing. Now, I'm not going to go to Broadway. I don't want to. I love my job. I don't want to do anything more with it than enjoy the pleasure of singing. So if there's anything in your life that you dream about, know that alcohol will suck it out of you. Alcoholics Anonymous will give it back to you. And I love you for that gift. Thank you.